Welcome to This Week in Christian History, a podcast from the Center for Christian History at Mississippi College. The Center for Christian History is dedicated to expanding knowledge and understanding of Christian history. Our mission is to provide a scholarly, unbiased look at the events, figures, and movements that have shaped Christianity over the centuries. You can visit centerforchristianhistory.com for daily historical highlights. And each week on this podcast, we'll do a deep dive into key moments with Christian history's leading authorities. Our first historical highlight for the week is Lottie Moon, one of the pillars of the Southern Baptist denomination. Originally a school teacher, Moon gave up her life of comfort and security to follow the call of the Great Commission. She was appointed a missionary to China on July 7, 1873, and she left the United States shortly thereafter. Moon made an impact on the Chinese people, especially the Chinese children, by being their friend before she attempted to evangelize them. She often offered them tea cakes and became known as the Cookie Lady in her Chinese community. Moon served in China for 39 years. The major Christmas time offering in Southern Baptist churches is named in honor of her. Our next historical highlight is Archbishop of Canterbury, Stephen Langton. Langton was responsible for the insertion of chapter divisions into the Bible. While this certainly aided in Bible study, as it allowed church members to reference specific passages of Scripture with ease, many disagree with some of the decisions that Langton made. One of the most prominently contested of his decisions is the end of Isaiah 52, which many believe ought to have been included with Isaiah 53 instead. Langton died on July 9, 1228. Our final historical highlight for the week and the subject of our deep dive is John Calvin. Born in France on July 10, 1509, Calvin became a minister at 27 years old and would preach until he died. His book, The Institutes of the Christian Religion, is still regarded as one of the most influential theological works ever written. Today in our deep dive, Nick Walters, director of the Center for Christian History, talks with Corrine Mogg of Calvin Theological Seminary about John Calvin.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of This Week in Christian History. And we are doing another deep dive into learning some things that happened this particular week in Christian history. And we're going to talk about someone whose name is more than well known for almost a majority of, let's say, of the pew sitters out there, John Calvin. And we're using the anniversary of his birth on July the 10th, 1509. And we have Dr. Corrine Mogg, who is with us, who is with the manages the Meter Center for Christian for Calvin Studies up in Michigan, right? So Dr. Mogg, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be here.
Very cool. So let's just jump in and talk a little bit about Calvin himself. How did he get from, how did he kind of really begin getting into this theological giant that he was, right? I mean, how did that start? Was he trained that way, or did he
It's a fascinating question when you think about it. And it's true for all the reformers. It's not just Calvin, right? If you think about Martin Luther, or you think about the Swiss reformer, Huldrych Zwingli, they all grew up in a Catholic world, right? They're all born good Catholics. Sure. They're baptized Catholics. They go to church as Catholics. Calvin was the same. And in his early years, there was nothing particular that would say, hey, this man is going to become this famous reformer. If anything, at first, his father wanted him to be a Catholic priest, sent the boy to school, sent him to university. Everything looked on track to be a good Catholic priest. His dad then had a falling out with the Catholic authorities in his hometown and sent young John to study law instead. So a career change. That.
And he's in France, right?
Wasn't he born in France? France? Absolutely, yeah, right. In France. And this is now the 1520s, right? So the Reformation, Luther, 1517. But that hasn't really spread very far yet. So in France at 1520, John Calvin's a good Catholic boy. And what then tended to happen, and it's never, Calvin never really explains very clearly his conversion experience from being Catholic to not being Catholic. He was very private about his own views, much, much different from Luther, who will tell you everything about how he ever felt about every single thing. Calvin, much more private, but he did say that in the 1530s, God suddenly converted him, but it was not explained exactly how or under what circumstances. And certainly by the mid-1530s, Calvin leaves France. He travels to the Swiss lands and he starts publishing works that sort of make him the reformer that he becomes. So his first edition of his most famous work, The Institutes of the Christian Religion, appears in 1536. So he's kind of compacted a lot of change in a fairly short space of time, from would-be Catholic priest to lawyer to humanist scholar to reformer in a very short space of years.
Well, but I mean, it's not like he was out, you know, herding sheep or something. I mean, right. I mean, he at least was in an academic world where studied, learned, and maybe where his epiphany was, or some passage that really lit his brain up or made him go, what the heck, or whatever. We don't necessarily know that, but it's not like he just came totally in, you know, from chopping, you know, being a woodsman or something. Right?
Exactly. Exactly. He had an intellectual training. And in fact, his training as a lawyer is probably very important because he had an incisive mind. He had the kind of mind that can organize and think clearly about things. So often people say about Calvin that he's a second generation reformer, right? Mm. Luther is a generation older, right? Luther is born in 1483. Calvin's born in 1509. That's a generation different, right?
Sure.
So Calvin comes in where the ideas of the Reformation begin to circulate. Calvin learns from them, builds on them, and then also organizes them. And he's very good at that. He's very good at laying out, okay, here are the implications of what we believe. And here's why this belief makes sense. And he does that in his institutes. He does it in his commentaries. He does it in his sermons. I mean, the guy published and published. It was crazy how much he worked.
He didn't just turn his brain off and go snow skiing sometime. All right. It was always going. So how did for folks who might not be as familiar with it, you know, whenever you have one where doctrine is all controlled and done through the papacy and through the whole time of how all that comes into, you know, things that had already been decided and, you know, the story was over. That's a lot cleaner, neater, nicer way to be able to do it, because there's not a whole lot of dissension, right? You'd move that out of the way, and now everybody, like their own nose, has their own opinion about the way they're reading things in Scripture, understanding that we have to define what Scripture is based off of what that would be. But then, I kind of see it this way instead I kind of see it that way. And so the Reformation during his time period, right, was kind of messy sometimes. Is that a good way to say it?
Extremely messy. The problem is that once you start to divide, that process just perpetuates itself. And the fracturing of Christendom, which took place at the Reformation, people of good faith, all kind of thinking they have their understanding is correct, they just tend to split and split and split and split. So the Lutherans and the Reformed folks didn't get on. The Lutherans and the Reformed didn't like the Anabaptists. The Catholics didn't like any of the Protestants, and vice versa. You know, it just gets very fragmented. The other thing we have to understand is you can't really understand the Reformation solely through the lens of doctrine, because it's always enacted in a particular place and in a particular situation. The thing that's really hard for us today to understand, especially from our own context, is just how integrally linked church and belief was with political power. Right. Mm-hmm. So even after the Reformation, these are all state churches, apart from the Anabaptists who do their own thing. The Lutherans and the Reformed, they're creating state churches where the pastors are paid by the government. They're civil servants. And it's mind blowing for my students today to think about that, because they're so used to the separation of church and state. And that's how it should be.
Right.
The Reformation does not follow that model at all. So when Calvin gets to Geneva, right? He's not from Geneva. He's from outside Geneva. Geneva's a small town, not even in part of the Swiss territories. It was separate. It was part of the Duchy of Savoy, a Catholic duchy. The Reformation was voted on, like vote in favor of the Reformation, yes or no. And they all voted in May 1536. All the hands go up. Do you want the Reformation? Yes or no. And a whole lot of people vote. And from then on, the mass is banned in Geneva. You can't live there and practice Catholic faith anymore. If you live in Geneva, you pretty much have to accept the fact that everything is reformed, and it's by government mandate. And it's very different to what we're used to.
It sounds like the Puritans and the Pilgrims in Massachusetts Bay Colony, right? I mean,
they follow in that lineage. They follow in that lineage. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So what was it like for Calvin to go, for example, like Luther, if I remember correct, and correct me if I don't have this wrong, but whenever the German Peasants War came about, he kind of got into it and he kind of got out of it and was like, oh, we don't need to be. It almost seemed like he was just trying to separate himself from that. Calvin, though, was like, hey, we're in it, right? I mean, we got a community, we got Geneva, we're going to, you know, this is the way it's going to be. How do you go from this theological academic mindset into creating this governmental infusion, if you will, about the way the city?
I mean, it is complicated. And again, it's very different from what we're used to. So Luther with the Peasants' War, I mean, Luther had preached a message that said that, as you said earlier, everybody should be reading the Bible and interpreting the Bible. And the peasants and the supporters of the peasants took this very literally and did so, and then went in directions that Luther never intended. And he's saying, no, I didn't mean that. I didn't mean that you were not going to pay your tithe anymore. I didn't mean that you were going to get to choose, you know, what you wanted to do. That's not what I meant. So there's a problem of the message and how the message is heard. Now, Calvin in Geneva, it's really interesting. Calvin did not bring the Reformation to Geneva. That wasn't his job. That was previous pastors, other pastors, friends of his eventually, colleagues of his eventually, but it predates his arrival in the city. He never intended to come to Geneva. He never intended to be the reformer of Geneva.
Really?
All happened, you could think providentially if you want.
Yes.
Calvin was French. He had had to leave France because of his Protestant sympathies. He was in the Holy Roman Empire, the lands around the Rhine River, and he was going to go back to France briefly for a reason of an inheritance. And he stopped in Geneva overnight on his way back into France. He's not intending to stay.
Okay.
Genevans had accepted the Reformation in May. They'd all voted. Now it's August. Okay. Calvin's in town. He stops at the local hotel because that's where he's going to stay. The man who had brought a lot of the Reformation to Geneva, a man called William Farel, comes to see Calvin in his hotel room. He's heard of Calvin. Calvin has published the Institutes of Christian Religion. It's like the up-and-coming man. He comes to see Calvin. He says, Calvin, we need your help here. We've started a Reformation, but I need help. You need to stay and help me. Calvin says, nope, I'm going to be a scholar. I'm going to work in my study and I will write to support the Reformation. That's what I'm going to do. Farel says, but we need you. Calvin says, no. Farel says, yes. Calvin says, no. He goes back and forth until Farel said, God will curse you unless you stay and help.
How about that?
Apparently, Calvin was terrified and decided he had to stay, right? So he is the implementer, right? He's not the one who made the Reformation take hold or organize the vote or anything like that. He sees his role as implementation, and it is not an easy road, right? Because a lot of people who voted for the Reformation, so think about it. Who gets to vote and who doesn't get to vote in an early modern city? So if you had to think about categories of people, who would you think does not vote?
Women.
Women, no women. So half your population is not voted.
No landowners, probably. You probably had to own land. Did you, right? Property owner?
It's the people at the top of society, the guys at the top of society that vote. There's a whole pile of men who don't vote, and there's all the women who don't vote. And even among those who do vote, why were they saying yes to the Reformation? Many of them for political reasons. Because their overlord was the Catholic Duke of Savoy. And if we say yes to the Reformation, we're saying yes to political independence from the Catholic overlord. So we want the Reformation. We have no idea what it means, right? So imagine Calvin's struggle. He comes into Geneva and he's got to, with his colleagues, and not just Calvin by himself, but with his fellow pastors, move an entire community of some 15,000 souls from Catholic to Protestant. Now, how'd you do that exactly?
Right.
And that was his challenge.
You can watch Teresa Nick's interview with Corinne Mogg on the Center for Christian History website at centerforchristianhistory.com. This Week in Christian History is produced for the Center for Christian History by Blue and Gold Media at Mississippi College in cooperation with the MC Department of Communication. For episode transcripts and more information, visit centerforchristianhistory.com. Be sure to subscribe on Spotify, Apple, YouTube Music, or wherever fine podcasts are found. Our next episode is coming next week. Thank you for listening.